everyone. Today, our discussion references Scientology a lot, and it occurred to me after I was editing that we might have used a few words or names that wouldn't be in everyone's vocabulary. Maybe if you've never been in Scientology or have better things to do with your life than watch an endless stream of Scientology documentaries or read an endless list of books like me. So before we start, Scientology is a cult started in 1950 by L. Ron Hubbard, a science fiction writer. When he died in 1986, a man named David Miscavige took over leadership of the church. L. Ron Hubbard created, quote, the bridge to total freedom, which is essentially a chart that documents how Scientologists advance within the religion and achieve salvation. It is very complex, very expensive, and takes decades to complete. It's also bananas. So now that we've covered some basics, let's move to the interview.
Today we are interviewing Jeanette Allen, representative of FACT, Families Against Cult Teachings, and EndingAbuse.org. FACT is an organization devoted to helping those victimized by cults, from the members and ex-members of destructive cults to their families and friends. One person's involvement can impact an entire community, and I'm really grateful for the tireless work FACT does in raising awareness and sharing information about cults. So thank you for being here, Jeanette.
Thank you for having me.
You are an activist with many years' experience in a cult and many years independently studying these topics. Scientology is possibly the most controversial and largest cult in the world. So the first thing I want to ask you is, how did you get into Scientology?
So I was freshly out of high school. I was 19, and I was living in Texas with my family, of course, and went on vacation with my grandmother. And we came to Florida, Clearwater, Florida, where my uncle had lived for many years, and he was a longtime Scientologist. And so I lived with him and my grandmother in his home. And basically, in a nutshell, he found a little bag of marijuana, you know, in my possession. And he thought that he needed to save me, quote unquote, from a life of drugs and partying. And he proceeded to flush my marijuana down the toilet and basically convinced me to take some of the three basic classes in the Church of Scientology here in Clearwater to get me on the right path, so to speak. And he did, you know, that I'm not going to deny that I was, you know, freshly out of high school. You really don't know what you want to do with your life yet. You're kind of searching for things and answers, and coming from a small town in Texas to a beach town in Florida, I was like, woohoo, you know, life's great. So I think to some degree he did, you know, he did what he thought best for me. And I did get a lot of good basic information from those lower end classes within the church. So that's in a nutshell how I got involved.
I see. You know, it's interesting. I heard in Scientology that, you know, now a lot of the people who are in are second, third generation Scientologists.
Right. That's very accurate.
So what were your early experiences like within the church? What made the group seem appealing to you? I know that you said a lot of people like the clean lifestyle that they really encourage or demand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for me, it was, I came from a large family of eight brothers and sisters, and bit dysfunctional, you know. My parents were from the, you know, they were flower children from the 70s, you know, and, you know, they were a bit dysfunctional. I think a lot of parents were back then or still are, but a little bit of chaos that went on in our family, you know, alcohol, this sort of thing. And so I think the community itself, being part of a tight-knit community where everybody wanted to help each other and everybody seemed nice and they just wanted to do good things for the community and the world at large. It was just very inviting to me. Felt like an instant family, so to speak.
Right.
And I felt very welcomed, and I did definitely get love bombed, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with that term, but
yes.
Basically when, okay, good.
But please go on.
Okay, so basically when potential new members get introduced to the community or to the quote-unquote religion, they're given lots of praise and lots of attention for wanting to do better and be a part of this movement. And so that, I mean, that obviously helped when you're getting lots of attention as a young adult and lots of praise that, you know, I didn't know at the time that it was a tool of manipulation, but that was certainly appealing to me.
Right. I've seen a lot of Scientology documentaries and that kind of thing and read some books. And I know that something they do sometimes with new recruits is that they have you attend like classes or workshops or little courses that are somewhat like therapeutic exercises being conducted with a bunch of people in a room or one-on-one. Were you involved in any of those sort of therapeutic like introductory courses?
Oh, sure. So not many, but I certainly had my, my doses of them. You may be referring to like the TRs, the training routine courses. Is that what you're like, where people are faced each other and staring at each other or doing specific drills to, is that or no?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. That's exactly what I'm trying to get at.
All right. Good. So there's a couple of different kinds of those courses. So, The very basic one that my uncle first bought me, that's called the communication course. And so basically it just kind of gives you drills and information on how to, quote unquote, communicate better with people about various topics. And so there's different levels of those TRs, which stands for training routines. And it's been a while, but I think they're on the very basic class, there was like 9 of them or 8 of them, 8 drills. And it gets a little weird because, you know, I felt very funny doing them, like sitting 3 feet across from somebody and having to sit there comfortably with my eyes closed for a while. And then the next one is with your eyes open. And the next one is what I forget the name of it, but where they push your buttons, so to speak, where you're not supposed to laugh or giggle or feel embarrassed. And it goes all the way up to, you know, other levels. But it felt very weird to me doing all of it, very foreign. Like, this is weird, you know? And when I was younger, I remember my uncle, when me and my sister got into a fight, say, he would sit us down and have us do exactly that. He put us 3 feet in front of each other in a chair. He goes, okay, you guys just sit there comfortably looking at each other until you feel better. And so after a couple of minutes, you know, doing that, we forgot all about what we were fighting about. And we were giggling and laughing, and whatever it was that we were fighting about mattered not.
Wow.
But later, yeah, which is like, I mean, imagine yourself sitting 3 feet across from somebody and just staring at them, quote unquote. That would, you know, all kinds of things go on in your mind, right? And
right.
Somebody itches their nose or whatever, you start giggling, whatever. It was kind of fun and fluffy when we were younger, but...
Right, and if it worked, I can see how that could be a powerful reinforcement, like, oh, this technique is working, like, we forgot, you know, we're no longer fighting.
Exactly, right?
We experienced some technical difficulty in our recording, which precludes me from being able to share the next minute of audio. But in it, Janet describes how she graduated from the lower level courses and signed up for a beefier course at FLAG, an important center for Scientologists in Clearwater. I apologize, you may hear some background noise over the next minute, but the audio of Janet describing the weird stuff they had to do was too good not to play.
There was a drill on there where I was supposed to command an ashtray to stand up and sit down and you know, talk to a Raggedy Ann doll. And I was just like, this is just nuts. I don't know what I'm doing here. This makes no sense to me. I wasn't understanding it. It just made me feel very, very uncomfortable. And that's the last time I ever did a class, because I never finished the class. I never finished it. I didn't ask for a refund, because obviously if you do that, you're going to get kicked out. But thank God I didn't finish that class, because that's really... that's where a lot of the hypnotism and the subconscious programming, I think, takes place, is when you're doing those upper level training routines. So something just told me in my gut, like, something ain't right here. And that was the last time I ever did a class. But I stayed in the community for many years after that, you know, raising my family. Yeah.
That's interesting, because I didn't know you could remain if you weren't actively in classes or progressing up the ladder.
Oh, yeah. No, I was definitely a rebel. I had one foot in and one foot out for so many years. I didn't do anything. And my husband at the time was active and joining staff. And I was, you know, I was concentrating on raising my child and my business. And I was like, well, you know, you do what you want to do. But my job is I want to be here for my kid. And I want to be at home nesting, you know. Mm-hmm. That's way more important to me than any kind of spiritual salvation. And that really took a toll on my marriage. And I was constantly being harassed, now that I look back at it, from Scientologists and Sea Org members. They would constantly come over or call, why aren't you on course? We got to get you back on the bridge. And, you know, this is your life, your spiritual salvation. I'm like, okay, well, I don't feel anything's wrong with me. So I'm just, you need to leave me alone. I'm being a mom and I'm working and I don't have time for this.
Wow. Well, that took a lot of courage.
I don't know about courage, but it took a lot of energy from me because it was a constant thing. Mm-hmm. It was a constant people blowing up my phone or coming over unannounced and uninvited and friends putting me on lists like, oh yeah, Jeanette needs to get back on, you know, into class and you should call her. And they'd leave me alone for months at a time, but then I'd be put on this list again. And then they, you know, harass me some more, or even go to my work, because I worked for Scientology companies for many years off and on. And they'd come to your job. And of course, as a Scientology business owner, they were very open to these Sea Org members coming over to try and quote unquote, save me.
Right.
Right.
Your husband was a Sea Org member himself?
No, he was not a Sea Org member. He was a staff member. So he, and not for very long periods of time, but he was a couple of times. And so the difference between a staff member and a Sea Org member is a staff member would be, say they would sign a 2.5 year, a 5 year contract at one of the lower organizations, either a mission or a Class 5 organization is what they called it. So those are two organizations underneath the Sea Org. And so Sea Org members, those are the people who sign the billion-year contract that are equivalent to like a Catholic nun or priest who devotes their entire life and, you know, gives up their home or their cars and they live in staff berthing and basically give up all their freedoms to work for the church.
Right. Got it. Thank you. Thanks for clarifying, because I just assumed any staff member was a Sea Org.
No.
Okay.
No.
So you, when you say that you stopped during that one class, was that before you got on the bridge or did you stop at some point on the bridge?
That was, so that class was pretty much one of the first steps on the quote unquote bridge. Classes before that are just introductory classes, and then they aren't necessarily on the bridge to total freedom. There's a whole chart. So that first initial class is, so there's the purification rundown, which I did once. And then after that, there's the TRs and objectives course. And that's, I think, you know, the second step on the bridge from my recollection. But yeah, after that, I didn't do anything.
So it sounds like you were willing, but not necessarily an enthusiastic member of the church.
I was willing to the point. Yeah, I was willing to be a part of the community. For looking back, like I can sum it up like this, that I was enthusiastic about being a member of the community to the degree that I was able to help in the social betterment aspects mm-hmm. of the church. So like, for instance, during Hurricane Katrina, right, I was part of the volunteer ministers, and we got together a whole caravan of, I think, 6 or 8 cars and trucks full of volunteers, and we drove up to the Hurricane Katrina area in Louisiana and passed out food and water and helped clean out churches. And that was the kind of, that was the reason I was a part of the Church of Scientology, because it gave me a platform. It gave me a community to where I can go out in the community and be of use and be of service. I didn't need to be part of the Church of Scientology for self-betterment because I didn't think there was anything wrong with me.
Right.
You know? And I was constantly being told that there was. And I just, like, oh, you could be so much better in this or that. And yeah, maybe I could, but I just don't feel like this is the route for me, you know? As far as the classes, I always felt dumb. I always felt ignorant going into these classrooms and reading these this encyclopedia of books that this man, quote unquote, wrote himself. And it just was just a bunch of mumbo jumbo crap to me. I felt ignorant. And so just like I did in high school, I wasn't a very good student. And a lot of it didn't make sense to me, especially the upper stuff, that the basic courses I did, you know, on finances and on marriage, that's very basic stuff. And that made sense to me. That's where I had my most successes. But after those basic classes, I'm like, I don't know what any of this other stuff is. And I'm not really interested.
Right.
And that's the trap, right? That's the trap, is that they get you on the basic classes and you get some successes and you have some useful tools, which these tools are universal tools, not just exclusive to Scientology, okay? Mm-hmm. And so that's where they trap you. And then they dangle this carrot like, oh, there's so much more to learn and, you know, it's going to cost you more and more and more until you're, you know, a couple $1 million in and you lose your family and your home. And, you know, to get to the upper levels of the bridge and OT 8 or 9 and beyond, it just didn't make sense to me. And I wasn't on board to any of that level by any means.
Right. Well, that kind of leads me into my next question, because there are a lot of accusations that Scientology is exploitive and it's abusive. And you've talked about them coming to your work and calling you, and I would call that harassment. But as far as like other forms of abuse or exploitation, can you speak to any of those accusations and what goes on in the church and what makes people say that?
Well, apart from me not experiencing any type of physical abuse, like I can't, you know, confirm or deny that those allegations are true or false. I mean, I wasn't there to get physically assaulted or put in the hole or whatever. But I believe that definitely happens. The exploitation and manipulation that I personally experienced was lots of high pressure, high demand of both my husband and I for more money donations and more volunteer time. It was never enough what we were willing to give. And what we did, it was just always more and more and more until it just sucked us dry. It depleted us, and it put a major wedge in between our marriage in many instances. They would come over, and I'd be off on my job or whatever, and CR members would come over, and they would sit with my then-husband, now ex-husband, but sit with him for hours, pressuring him endlessly to donate $20,000 or $50,000 or whatever it is. And they didn't care that I, his wife, was not, they preferred that I was out of the house because he was more active in the community and he had more of a desire to help than I did. I was more, you know, like 1 foot out by that point and was resistant to giving them more money and more time. I'm like, look, I have a family, a home, a mortgage. You know, I've got this going on. I don't have any money for you. Well, he was a little more helpful. He was the breadwinner, so to speak. And he wanted, men want to help save the planet and do good. And so they would hone in on his vulnerabilities of wanting to help to the point where he gave a lot of money.
Right.
To them without necessarily getting my agreement as his wife. And that made a huge impact on our marriage. Huge impact on our marriage.
Right. Something not covered in their marriage classes.
Well, they don't care. No. Yeah, they don't care what marriage or what relationship they split up as long as they get their bottom line. And I get it. Sea Org members are very much pressured from their bosses or whatnot to get their quotas met. But these are grown adults, and that doesn't make it right. It doesn't excuse them of their behavior as an individual, okay? Mm-hmm. Regardless if they're a Sea Org member or not, they still have a conscience, you know, and they still have a decision to make, like, okay, am I going to do this job or am I not going to do this job? Am I going to put a wedge between this marriage or, you know, they still have a responsibility. They can't, many of the people leaving the Sea Org and or who have left the Sea Org and now are out speaking out on television shows and whatnot, I'm sorry, but they can't claim, in my opinion, they can't claim victim and just blame it all on David Miscavige. Okay, they had a very intricate part in creating the culture that is today. You know, David Miscavige is not ultimately the only person responsible for this machine. There are hundreds of Sea Org members who towed the line and who helped create this machine. And all these people are shouting, it's all David Miscavige's fault. Well, I call bullshit.
Yeah.
Excuse my language.
No, not at all. Like, I understand why you say that, and it's actually a really powerful statement.
Hitler wasn't the only one responsible for the atrocities that he committed. If he did not have an army of, minions, mm-hmm. he could not have accomplished what he did. And it's the same kind of scenario. I don't mean to use that as an example. It's horrible, but
No, I understand.
You know, it's true.
And you're right. And it's funny you mentioned the Holocaust, because it just made me think of a Scientology museum that I went into once, just for research purposes. And it was the Museum of Psychiatry in Los Angeles. And mm-hmm. there's a whole section where they blame the Holocaust on psychiatry. This is mm-hmm. Scientologists, really. They blame every horrible, devastating world event throughout history on psychiatry. It's pretty, pretty amazing.
Right.
9/11 also.
Right. And yeah, exactly. So I was a part of CCHR. That's the whole branch. That's a front group of Scientology, Citizens Commission on Human Rights. And I was a volunteer there for many years. And so it's a classic case of us versus them, right? Mm-hmm. Scientology versus psychiatry. And it's a brilliant platform to raise a lot of money, to gain a lot of money and power and control. For something that is never going to get shut down. Or, you know, I used to go on pickets against psychiatry and psychiatrists and whatnot, and it felt good to be a part of something that had a real cause. And sure, there's been atrocities in psychiatry. Of course there have been, mm-hmm. right? But there's been a lot of good that has come from it as well. But the Church of Scientology uses that as a platform for us versus them. And that's classic cult mentality. It's a brilliant way to raise money for one of their front groups.
Right. And I think it must serve their purpose to have a common enemy, you know, like to create something that everyone can bond over in hating. I think that must be, a good way to get people to group together.
Absolutely. It's a great way to raise money, too.
Mm-hmm. And you're right.
There's a lot of money.
What you were saying before about the way they'll just like come and hound you for money over and over and over again and use different methods, like I would call that financial abuse. And I would also, I think their policy of disconnection is also abusive to its members. Can you speak to the disconnection policy?
Absolutely. So when we finally woke up, my husband and I finally woke up, it was right around 2009 or 10. When the St. Petersburg Times did their whole truth rundown expose. And this one was when some of the top ex-members of the Sea Org were coming forward and giving their accounts of abuse and what was really going on at the top of the church. And we finally woke up after being harassed for years for more money and more time. And we were just fed up and burnt out. And so we finally read the articles and watched the interviews and we're like, oh my God, we've been in a cult, you know, all these years. And, you know, we never really knew what a cult was. We didn't get this information in high school. You know, nobody taught us what a cult was. This is a religion, a church. And so when we finally woke up to that, we had to somewhat stay quiet about it for a good year, year and a half, we were still in the church, well, in the church community, I should say. I had my business is a very thriving cleaning business, and I worked for very wealthy Scientologists, and most of my clients were Scientologists. My husband at the time was working for a consulting company who was a Scientologist. And so we had to be very careful about speaking our mind because we could very much lose our jobs and our whole community. So we kept quiet about it and just kind of kept to ourselves as much as possible. And then one day we went to this barbecue where a bunch of the top former members were gathering. We wanted to go and speak to them ourselves and get it from the horse's mouth, you know, their stories. And then there was a picture taken with the group of us, and that picture somehow got back to OSA, which is the intelligence arm of the church. And they proceeded to give it to one of our best friends, quote unquote. And she basically spread it all over the Facebook and internet saying, if you've been wondering why Jeanette and Brett have been distant and acting weird lately, this is why. They're mingling with the enemy, the apostates. And overnight, instantly overnight, I lost all of my business. My husband at the time, my ex-husband, got fired from his job 2 days later. All of our friends in this community, we raised our family, and we've been part of this community in Clearwater, Florida for 20-something years. Every one of our friends, with the exception of maybe three or four, turned their back on us instantly. No questions asked. Our children's friends, lifelong friends, wrote emails, sorry, I got to disconnect from you, your parents are apostates. Overnight, within 3 days, our entire life had just crumbled.
Oh my God. That's
just
so
just like that. You know, no more business for me. My husband lost his job. We're like, oh my God. You know, and we're in downtown Clearwater. Like, what do we do now? Right.
Ugh.
And it
what
was
did
horrible.
You do? How did you pick up and move on?
It was horrible. And just days prior to this, you know, Sierra members were coming over. My daughter at the time was 15, and they were love bombing her. They would come over. They would go to her school, which she went to Delphi Academy, which is in Clearwater, and that's a Scientology based school and run by primarily Scientologists. And they would actually go to her school and pull her out of class, and the teachers there allowed them to come in and pull her out of class to try and recruit her into the Sea Org. And when I found out about that, I stormed into that school. You know, I'm paying $800 a month and for a good private school education. And I stormed into that school. I said, what gives you the right to let some stranger walk into my daughter's classroom and pull her out of class? I said, do you realize that's illegal? I'm paying you eight. I said, if this ever happens again, I will sue you. And I decided that day to pull her out. So I pulled her out, and they would come over to my house, and these young SeaWorld members who were just babies themselves, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, we just want to talk to her. We just want more control over her. I'm like, listen,
oh,
I said, I'm the one who gave birth to this 9-pound baby. I said, you don't get any control over her. I said, you get your little ass off my property right now before I call the cops on you. I was so livid. That's, you know, I told my husband at the time, I said, they're after my kid, our kid, and my mama bear claws is about to come out, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, there's no way that she's going to be any part of the Sea Org or anywhere near it. And she was prime picking too, you know, because they're young and vulnerable. And they were, she got a stack of letters in the mail and a big old envelope, 50 letters. Telling her, oh my God, you'd be so good at this position, and you're so talented. And they were love bombing her. And I just threw the letters out. She never received them. I just threw them out.
Good.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I understand you can be protective over your kids in a way you never can over yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So after that, we had no choice but to basically formulate a plan to move out of the area because you know, it was just, it's too traumatic. It was too, too much chaos going on. You know, why stay in an area where you're being hated on
and preyed upon?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. We had, David LeBeau following us. He's one of the church's main private investigators. He would follow us occasionally. It got to be too much, and I just wanted peace. And so we, thankfully we had a little bit of money saved, not a lot, but we packed up when we moved to Colorado at that point. So my husband at the time had his oldest daughter and her mom, who was still very much involved in Scientology. And so they were still in Clearwater. And so once we moved to Colorado, we get a letter from his daughter officially disconnecting from us.
Oh.
And so that hit him obviously very hard, and my daughter as well, and me as well, all of us. The disconnection can be very brutal. And traumatic, without a doubt. And I know many, many people who still have no connections with their children because of this insidious policy.
Right.
Or their parents, for instance.
This policy, you know, rips families apart. And just to be clear, like the church, like the policy is that if you are no longer a member of the church, or if you are critical of the church, or whatever it is that gets you declared as a suppressive person, then you're not allowed, if you're within the church, you're not allowed to have contact with those people, right?
Correct.
Right.
That's correct.
That is, I mean, so incredibly harsh. So I think there are a lot of forms of abuse going on. There's financial, and then there's emotional. And and correct me if I'm wrong, but when you say you had a private investigator following you, did you think that that was just a form of intimidation to get you to submit?
I really didn't know. You know, I was like, why is he following us? We're just, you know, these little peons in this community. They were following us probably because we had went to that initial barbecue where some of the top executives had, the ex-executives have come out, and we were hanging out with them here and there. So they were probably following us to try to, you know, get information on them or whatnot, because we don't have anything, you know, any information or whatnot. There'd be no reason to follow us to any degree. But some of the top ex-members like Mike Rinder or Marty Rathman or Debbie Cook, perhaps, all those top dogs, so to speak, are probably followed and harassed constantly, because they know they have dirt, you know, they have dirt on David Miscavige, or they have a much bigger platform to speak out about the church, and the abuses that go on. So, but you know, little members like us, you know, me and my ex, we don't get followed anymore. We don't, you know, there's nothing to, you know, nothing right for them to find out about us. But getting back to the disconnection part, you know, we were very, very lucky in that we finally convinced my stepdaughter, my husband's eldest daughter, to get out.
That's wonderful.
And that's very, very, very rare. That's very, very rare, especially given the fact that her mom was very involved as well. And so we had formulated a little bit of a plan, you know, and here's what we're going to do. And it worked. And the next thing you know, after we kind of implemented that plan, 2 days later, his daughter was on a plane to Colorado to come see us and reconnected with us. And that was, she was hiding that from her mom at the time.
Was the plan, so, did that involve an intervention of some kind? Or just getting information to her somehow?
The intervention was as basic and as simple as this. There was no experts involved. What I had done, because I was so upset and I had to do it, I didn't see any other way. I talked to my daughter, and so I said, look, you know, your oldest sister is in a situation, and she is your oldest sister, and here's what I think you need to do. I think you need to basically chew her out, you know, I think you need to tell her this, this, and this, and say, you know, you're my oldest sister, and I can't believe you disconnected from your own father. I don't respect you anymore. I'm appalled. And so at first she did not want to do that. She's like, no, I don't want to do that, because she's going to disconnect from me. And I don't want that. So I didn't force her to do it, obviously. I said, okay, well, you think about it, you know, but at this point you're the only person that's in touch with her on this side of the family. And I think that that's very powerful. And I think that you can affect some real change here. And so it was kind of a tough love approach of my youngest kind of chewing her sister out, and couple that with my husband at the time still texting his daughter and saying, look, I'm still the same guy you always known. I love you, this and that. I think between the two strategies and the two approaches, it really worked. And so the next day she was on a plane to come visit us.
Wow. I'm so happy to hear that. Like, you're right. I'm sure that's incredibly rare. And I'm really, really glad that your family had that happy outcome in this one circumstance.
Thank you. We're happy about it too.
Well, you've made the decision, the brave decision, to at least on one occasion confront a church member down in Clearwater, Florida, with, you know, language about the fact that they're a cult. And now you're an mm-hmm. activist. You speak very plainly about Scientology, and you warn others. And because Scientology has such a reputation for harassment and suing, I was wondering, how do you find the strength to commit to this kind of work? And have there been any other experiences in which you worried about the church coming after you?
No, I'm not worried about it at all. Like I said, I'm in the scheme of things, in the scheme of activists that are out there, I never was at the top of the church. I never was an executive. And those are the people that the church hires private investigators to harass and try to get information on. I was never at any executive level. So I don't feel at all intimidated or threatened or have any worry whatsoever about being harassed or followed. I just don't.
Well, that's good. It makes me feel good personally too, because I had a little trepidation about even embarking on this season and mentioning Scientology, because the reputation for their litigious behavior is so strong that I was like, could I get, like, are they going to come after me just for talking about them publicly? But I guess not. I guess maybe the reputation might exceed their own abilities.
Yeah, I think it's blown out of proportion, and the fear of that happening to the everyday activist, I don't see it. For the top X members like Mike Rinder and others that were at his caliber of executive level, and with his show that he's currently doing, of course they're going to get harassed. Leah Remini, all of them, you know, those are big voices, right? And they have a lot of money backing them. So I think they're only going to harass and try to attack the big guns, so to speak, in this war.
Right. Makes sense. Well, now you work with FACT and its sister website, endingabuse.org. And I was struck by the name FACT, which is Families Against Cult Teachings, because of its focus on family. And as we talked about, you know, with the disconnection policy, for an example, the way these cults can split up families. And I think, you know, that's probably true across the board. Every time a person is recruited into a dangerous organization, the entire family and suffers, friends in the community, et cetera. Like, it affects many people. So what I'm hoping to do right now is seize the opportunity to talk about the information every family should have before, during, and after their loved one gets involved in a cult or any harmful organization. So let's start with prevention. What would you say is the best way to prevent recruitment by an abusive organization?
Okay, good. So with anything, I think that the only way and the most effective way to prevent is to educate. And so the most vulnerable people, in my opinion, in my experience working with FACT, the most vulnerable people are young adults in college. Because across America, there are countless number of cult-like groups who recruit on college campuses. And we get calls daily and emails daily to this exact point. And so when you're a young adult away from home for the first time, that's a very vulnerable person. Like any young adult, you're looking to find your place in the world and looking to be perhaps a part of something bigger and better than yourself, right? So arming these young adults and the parents and the teachers and advocates and about the red flags of cult recruitment and how they recruit and what they do once they get their claws in to new recruits it's life-saving work, and it needs to be done. It's imperative. And recruitment happens very innocently, you know, come to a free lunch. Here's a free book. Come to a Bible study. It's very innocent, and, you know, it's very innocent to go to a Bible study or go to a free luncheon or a free lecture. And then once these new recruits are there, or potential new recruits, they get love bombed and they get a little bit of truth, a little bit of information that makes sense to them that they can latch onto. And you couple that with being love bombed and all these new friends and an instant family atmosphere, and boom, they got you. Right. It's that easy and that quick. And I work with families all the time who are like, my daughter was not raised in this religion. She was perfectly fine up until a year ago. Now she won't talk to us. We try to write her letters, and, you know, I try to counsel them, like, okay, good. So, you know, the main thing is to stay in communication with them. Don't make them wrong. Don't say they're in a cult. You know, they're looking for something and they found something within that group. And the last thing you want to do is alienate them. But, you know, more times than not, once the parents come to us, they've already been alienated. They've already alienated themselves from their child because they didn't know any better. Right.
Right.
So once that alienation happens, it's very, very difficult to undo it. So preventative education, not only for young adults, but for also parents who are sending their children off to school, is essential. Like, this is a problem in society. There are more cults now than there were in the 70s, I believe. So, preventative education is key. And that's is my main focus moving forward, is prevention, and also being a support network for those who have survived cultic abuse or sociopathic relationship abuse. 'Cause the bottom line is this: abuse is going to happen. It's out there. It's ugly. It's in every facet of life. It's in church communities. It's in gurus. It's in school systems. It's in the foster care system. It's in homes. Abuse happens in every area of life. And I can't be there to stop it. You can't be there to stop it. But what can we do as an organization is we can try to prevent it. And we can also be a support network for those who have survived it. And that's anything other than that is getting in the middle of wars. And it's very depleting, and it's very time consuming. It does not necessarily yield any result.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
It does make sense. And so endingabuse.org, it doesn't differentiate really between like cultic abuse and other forms of abuse. It's just use the same techniques to help share information and emotionally support in the aftermath.
That's correct. I mean, FACT was born out of the love of a father and a family, and how Tibor Stern, the president, lost his daughter to suicide as a result of a sociopathic relationship that his daughter got involved in from being at school. This was her teacher at Naropa University. And she got involved with him with the dance program. And he mentally exploited her, financially exploited her, played head games with her for years, to the point where it drove her to the brink of insanity, and she committed suicide. And that's why FACT was born. And it has evolved, you know, we had concentrated on exposing, doing exposés and trying to help people and get out of these cults. And it's tireless work. It's endless work. And, you know, at the end of the day, I just was like, look, if I'm going to continue doing this work, I want to be effective, you know, and I want to help people win. And I can't win battles between huge organizations like Scientology or Jehovah Witnesses. Like they have millions and millions of dollars, mm-hmm. you know, I can't shut them down. We're a small organization, you know, but I can help prevent people from joining, and I can create programs that will help people heal in the aftermath of their abusive experiences. And that's where I'm willing to put my time and my energy.
So both of your sites are filled with helpful information for parents and children and friends and anyone looking to receive the material they need to approach cults or people in cults thoughtfully. So if people want to learn more about you and learn more about these efforts within your websites, how can they do that?
They can visit our website, either familiesagainstcultteachings.org or endingabuse.org. They can send us an email through the websites. There's a toll-free number on both sites. They can reach out. We've got several programs that we're implementing with endingabuse.org. Art for therapy is one of them. Art is a very therapeutic medium for trauma survivors. Books, you know, for therapy. A lot of people, like when I was going through my crisis and whatnot, I couldn't afford therapy, but I got my hands on every book that I could, you know, and I read my way through to healing. And so books are very powerful and very easily obtained, either through your library or friends or what have you. So we have a program there where one can apply and choose whatever books they want from the list that we have, and we're more than happy to gift them to them. And they're in the future, we're looking at a peer-to-peer support retreat where survivors of abuse and advocates and or people who are finding their children in abusive religious situations or abusive situations all together. They all come together, share experiences, share stories, share advice. That's on the horizon. And then we're also looking at a scholarship program, the Sharoni Stern Scholarship Fund. And that's something we're looking forward to, where abuse victims or survivors can apply. And if they want, you know, to take their life back and want to restart their life, they're on the other side of the darkness, right? And they've survived and they want to move forward in life. There's going to be a scholarship fund there to help abuse survivors move forward. So lots of positive, hopeful programs that we're trying to implement, and a lot of light and love and hope for the future, you know, for abuse survivors. So that's what we're trying to concentrate on, as well as our preventative education initiative and study guide that's in the works. And we're hoping to raise awareness and some much needed funds to try and get this study guide in every high school and every college campus in America to help prevent, help educate, and ultimately prevent vulnerable young adults from getting trapped into these types of situations.
Wow.
So a lot of programs that need support from the general public, and one organization cannot do it alone. We definitely need support from the public and society.
Mm-hmm. And there's a donate page where you can contribute to these efforts on your site, right?
Right. There's a donate page on both the FACT website as well as endingabuse.org.
Thanks to Jeanette Allen for this wonderful talk and for the tireless work she does. On Wednesday, we're listening to episode 6 of Lola's story, in which we learn more about her motive by discussing the tapestry. The cohesive unit, Lola claimed she believed, would be disrupted by a member of TCS leaving, disruption that could result in worldwide disaster. See you then.